before we turn to your essential political analysis for this week, I want to tell you about our wonderful partners at The Resident, where all rooms are designed to combine pure comfort with quintessential British style and design. Whether you're escaping to London for a romantic break or visiting the city with friends and family, there's no better place to stay in the heart of the neighbourhood. Without The Resident, you might not get to experience London. And without The Resident, we wouldn't be here on Whitehall Sources. Whitehall Sources, your essential politics podcast, is brought to you in association with The Resident. And welcome to Whitehall Sources. I'm Callum MacDonald. We're recording on Thursday, the 18th of April. We are taking you inside politics to analyse all that's been going on this week. I say we because here's Kirsty Buchanan, former special advisor to Theresa May. Hello, Kirsty.
Good morning to you.
Are you well?
No, not at all. So, obviously, we were off last week because I had an operation. The operation was fine, but somewhere in the mix, I picked up a terrible chest infection. So, I sound bad, but if you'd caught me earlier on the week, I sounded like I'd been possessed by the Antichrist. So, but I might have to break off and cough on a regular basis.
Well, that's all right. Thank you for being here. We're glad it went well last week as well. And we're glad to see you back.
Thanks.
Also with us today to cover up for Kirsty's coughing primarily. No, I'm joking. To offer his insight and expertise, we have James Price, who's now at the Adam Smith Institute. But James, you worked for, well, all sorts of people in government. Hello, first of all. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. I've not been possessed by the Antichrist, but if I had been, that's what I would say.
Right. James, don't make me laugh too much, because this is really painful.
It's going to be a thing. James, give us a bit of CV. Remind us who you worked for.
Well, when I first started in Westminster over 10 years ago, I was a young girl with a dream. And I don't know if you can see from the beard and the hangdog expression, it's all gone wrong since. I've worked in think tanks. I've worked for the Conservative Party. I've worked in five different special advisor roles, including inter alia, education, the Treasury, the Cabinet Office. I've been an evil corporate lobbyist. Who knows what fresh hell is to come after that.
So when we say we take you inside politics, that's why these people know what they're doing.
In the words of Johnny Cash, you've been everywhere, man.
That's right.
That's it, exactly.
And now you're here, for which we're very grateful. Right, lots to talk about today. Liz Truss has a book out, you may or may not have seen.
Does she? I hadn't noticed.
We will be talking about Kemi Badenoch as well. Sorry, in the context of the smoking ban, and of course, leadership rumblings within the Conservative Party. That's definitely a thing. Also, Rwanda bill ping pong continues. So we'll bring you up to date on that. But first, we want to start with the exclusive front page story of the Times, the headline of which is revealed Tory MP allegedly demanded campaign cash to pay bad people. The suggestion here is that Mark Menzies, Conservative MP for Filled, is under investigation now over allegations that he misused campaign funds and abused his position after making a late night phone call saying he'd been locked up by bad people, quote, who were demanding thousands of pounds. He rang an elderly local party volunteer at 3:15 in the morning in December, saying he was locked in a flat and needed £5,000 as a matter of life and death. That amount then went up. It was paid by his office manager. These are the allegations from her own personal bank account, and then subsequently reimbursed as well. Now, there are all sorts of allegations and complications in all of this. The Conservative Party, though, has been aware of the allegations of potential fraud for more than 3 months and had taken no action. The MP was accused of paying for sex from a male escort in 2014. And I think, Kirsty, based on the complications that we're dealing with here on the various allegations, there are some real questions for the Conservative Party at this point. It's emerged that after a conversation last night, obviously ahead of the publication by the Times, that he was having the whip withdrawn. But the fact the Conservative Party's known for 3 months does leave them open to something of a crisis management situation here, does it not?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when politicians always sort of say, well, there are lessons to be learned here and never do, I'm not going to get involved in the specifics of the story. I don't know the chap. I don't know the details. It all sounds very complicated, let's put it that way. But it does have an air of the kind of Chris Pincher about it, doesn't it? It's not like, squeaky clean MP suddenly goes off the rails. It doesn't have that vibe about it. And again, it also has the realms of clearly a complaint was put in and nothing seemingly was done about it. And whoever put in the complaint in frustration has gone to the newspaper because this has not been well handled. It has the quality of an accident that was always waiting to happen and a crisis that was caused by poor management of it as much as anything else. The best thing to do with a crisis in the first place is get ahead of it, not wait for it to just kind of wake up one morning and bite you on the backside and you be on the back foot from the get-go. That's what appears. This is how not to do crisis management 101 again, isn't it?
And James, that's the thing. I mean, in many ways, this is a tale as old as time in sort of the principles that are at play here. Sure, the intricacies of it are reported in the Times today, but there's investigations ongoing, etc. But in terms of the political party management principles, it's almost as if there's nothing new here.
Yeah, as you said, a tale as old as time, but with a lot more beast and a lot less beauty, unfortunately. A couple of bits in this. I think one is this is the sort of lurid accusations, as you say. I think best not to go into, but can refer people to the copy of in the Times about it. The second thing here is about the potentially corrosive nature of Westminster life. Is this part of it? Is it the fact that people are half of the time they're in locked inside Parliament with the whip on, and there are opportunities for lots of alcohol to be consumed, for big age differences? I don't tend to ascribe to the kind of slightly Marxist power notion of everything is governed by power imbalances, but I do think that when you've got MPs and young staffers, there's these sort of power imbalances that come along, or younger campaign staff and those kinds of things, and then being away from home in two different places, all these sorts of things seem to make a kind of fairly vicious cycle for too many people. Is it the case that politics just attracts these sorts of people, or does it turn people and occasions into people who get into these sorts of scrapes? And there's a big problem there. I think there's also just the issue of people's judgment on these sorts of things. As much as we want to diagnose why it is that people end up making, pretty, let's say, poor life choices, the kinds of judgment displayed by here, by the honey trap scandal that's happened in the last fortnight as well, and God knows what else. So people wake up the next morning, MPs, with a literal hangover as well as a metaphorical one, and think that they see fit to be able to, vote on legislation to regulate artificial intelligence or anything else in this kind of complicated world when they fall for these basic kinds of mistakes, and there's a problem. And I think one thing perhaps it might be useful for us to talk about is the relationship between the way that central parties deal with these things and the whips offices as well, if we're getting inside politics on it.
It's a curious one, isn't it? Because the honey trap is another kind of classic example of just that sense of entropy that has kind of crept into the party, regardless of, there's two big problems here in party management. One is an outrageous lack of discipline, a handful of people making an awful lot of difficulties for the vast majority of Conservative MPs who are just trying to get on and do their jobs and do the best they can. But there's this kind of breakdown quality about, the sort of last days of Rome. I've looked it up because I can't remember it from my GCSE days, but I'm increasingly reminded of The Second Coming, the poem by W.B. Yeats. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The centre cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. That's kind of what the Tory party looks like these days, isn't it? Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. And where do you start if you're Keir Starmer at PMQs this week? Do you start with Liz Truss and her book about secret lefty cabals trying to bring her down? Or do you start with this? Or do you start with William Bragg and all the missteps he made over the honey trap scandal and the bizarre decision by Number 10 to call his, allowing himself to be compromised and then throwing colleagues under the bus by giving out his number to a stranger, calling that courageous because he got caught out by the press and, did a mea culpa. The whole thing is really baffling, I think. And I just, you almost want to go back and go, do you remember like when the Conservatives were sort of sensible and stood for sensible things? And, what happened to all of that? Where did it all go?
Down, absolutely right. I think the Tories probably wish you would be listening to your poem there of Yeats and thinking that mere anarchy, well, he'd take mere anarchy compared to what we've got, which seems pretty full-throated anarchy right now. It is, as you say, and I, look, I was the chief of staff to the chairman of the Conservative Party under the start of Rishi's tenure, and we inherited some of this stuff. And this wasn't one that was on my radar, but there are plenty of others that were. And look, all parties are probably about equally guilty of having these sorts of things happen. It used to be said that for Tories, it was always sex scandals, and for Labour, it was always money scandals, because that's what they couldn't get when they were younger. I'm not sure how much that holds anymore. But there's an awful lot of this stuff going on. I think part of the problem is you've got a very old school kind of archaic system in the sense of the whips operation. So the whips are there to maintain discipline. And what does that mean? Well, really, it just means making sure that backbenchers will vote the way that the government wants them to. Right? Like, I mean, this is what we're doing. We're all in this together. Have some discipline. It's for the good of the country. If you've got concerns, air them behind closed doors and we'll get you meetings with the minister and all the experts. But come on, be a good sort. That's what it should be. Now, for a long time, and still to an extent into today, the whips have these infamous little black books that contains all the sort of compromat and all the rest of it. And I think that the really horrible moment for me was an old documentary in the 90s of a whip from, I think, the 70s or 80s, who, when describing his little black book, one of the examples he gave was that one of the MPs liked, quote, little boys or something like that. And that rather than going to the police immediately on this, this was used as compromat and as leverage to try and make sure that these MPs would vote the right way. Mm. And that's a very old school system. It doesn't live in the world of Me Too or Time's Up or, frankly, any sense of moral common decency, and certainly not with any modern HR practices that are, I think, still shockingly lacking inside Parliament. The parties have really adopted a lot more of this kind of modern HR stuff. And so, you know, the Conservative Party under Theresa May changed a lot with the disciplinary processes that it had. Now, this was really meant for dealing with, you know, a naughty councillor who tweeted something stupid, and that there would be therefore a sort of a disciplinary procedure that wouldn't have looked out of place in a modern office, going, right, come on, you've done this naughtily here. Here's a process where you can put your evidence and your defence or whatever, and then various sanctions. When it comes to members of parliament and politics gets involved, especially when we've had small majorities under Theresa May, under the coalition, all these sorts of things, and therefore, you know, there was a, well, let's try and muddle through and get this guy back on his feet and all the rest of it so that we don't have the majority reduced anymore. That really butts up against the kind of morality of dealing with these things. And so, and the last thing on this is when Nadeem Zahawi and I were in CCHQ, you know, we saw the sort of slightly higgledy-piggledy approach to this, different lawyers being asked for things. There's no general counsel inside the party. It was a recommendation that I made and tried to get changed. We hired in proper criminal barristers to come in, really excellent, and ahead of one of the leading prosecutorial sets, a big, scary KC, who specialized in all the sort of most horrible things that you can imagine, just to have a look at everything and to go, right, well, this thing I've been hearing about, let's hear a bit more about this. The sort of whispers and things that are not very nice that sort of float around, and do a bit of a risk register, right? This thing here, well, this guy was an idiot for, I don't know, cheating on his wife or something. And if you as the whips want to use that as leverage, well, it's probably not illegal. It's maybe immoral and maybe not good for politics, but go at it. If you've heard that this person has, you know, drunk driven into a telephone cable in their village, in their constituency, and run off in the night, then that's a crime. And you need to get that reported and looked at and all the rest of it. So we'd actually have some kind of clarity on these things. And none of that stuff had really happened beforehand. And I don't know how much it's happened since we've left. But that kind of process is sorely lacking, because everything kind of slips through the crack of either the party or parliament or local associations and all these sorts of problems. I think that's where some of the problems come from as well.
It's true. I mean, obviously, Sexminster happened under my watch when I was, literally under my watch. It was the weekend, and obviously I was in charge of sort of number 10 comms at the weekend. And for those of you that have short memories, Sexminster was a list, anonymous list drawn up by, we believe, kind of parliamentary staffers of who to watch and who did what to whom. And it ranged in its sort of scale of seriousness from serious, you know, sexual assaults down to, I don't know, you know, relatively minor but completely unacceptable sexual behaviour, right? And I was given this kind of dump of this list and tried to find out, you know, what we needed to do and what responses we needed to come for the Sunday journalists, because obviously they were going to devote several pages to this huge, it was a huge scandal on the day. And the first thing I did was go to all the young people that work at CCHQ and say, if I find out, you know, these names, when they're put to me by the journalists, which are the ones that I should, you know, not fall off a chair about and be surprised about, and which are the ones that you would go, I'm not sure about that. And I got a list of people. And the reality of, in any kind of close-knit community, people will know. This is the whole point about Pincher and Boris appointing him as deputy chief whip. People vaguely, broadly know who the wrong ones are, right? And so, you know, there is a question here about whether you preemptively, because everybody kind of knows, whether you preemptively try and do something about that, or you sit there and wait till it blows up in your face, quite often at the expense of some young parliamentary vulnerable staffer, before you do something about it. And, you know, before we just spend all our time, you know, head kicking the Conservatives over this, you know, we had the same situation in Labour with disciplinary actions over anti-Semitism, which became so badly handled that the Equalities and Human Rights Commission ruled that they'd breached equalities law. And now, obviously, they're almost in the opposite kind of end of the spectrum, because they've had to take everything out from a disciplinary process into independent hands. And now Starmer's getting a kicking because, you know, why hasn't, you know, the independent process cleared Diane Abbott yet, quote unquote? Well, you know, you've got to take it out of, you know, party politics and put it in some independent, everybody is treated the same. And as James quietly said, you know, there's a kind of trigger mechanism. If this is always the response. If this is the charge, this is always. We haven't, you know, we are how many years on from Sexminster? We still haven't resolved issues like, if you're facing a charge, should you be on the estate? Should you not be on the estate? You know, we haven't sort of decided whether it's better to outsource or keep these things in-house. We really haven't, you know, cracked this nut, and it's not going to go away. And we have, more importantly, they have a responsibility to it. The parliamentary estate is full of a lot of young, impressionable, potentially vulnerable parliamentary staffers. On a duty of care basis alone, this is one of these things that, you know, the fact that it's slipped for as many years as it has, and it's kind of half-baked kind of solutions that haven't worked, really got to nail this. It's just going to keep coming back again and again and again until we get a uniformed, agreed, preferably outsourced disciplinary procedure that fits everybody, whether you're a Secretary of State or an MP or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then the last thing I'll say on it that it's not a happy point to say on it, to maybe end this section of, but is the idea that we are stuck in a bit of a vicious cycle now. Because what we desperately need in Westminster politics is, frankly, higher quality caliber members of parliament, right? So I took my old boss, Nadim Zahawi, before he was in parliament, he founded and built a now global unicorn tech firm in YouGov and learned so many amazing business skills and all the rest of it from his time in business that I saw be amazing in the vaccine rollout, in the Queen's funeral that he organized, all these sorts of things. How many people have got anything like that kind of experience in there now? And with that kind of experience gives you judgment, it gives you context, it gives you perspective. It says maybe when someone texts you, hey, send me a picture of your bits, and you don't know who they are, you don't do it, right? Simple stuff like that. But the reason this is a vicious cycle is that every highly qualified business person or charity head or just whatever wonderful person who thinks, Christ, my country's in a bit of a mess, I'm going to stick my hand up and go in and do it, will be like, what? I'm going to spend my time sat on the benches with this bloke who's got a dog drunk and this bloke who sent pictures of his bits and all these sorts of things. And you just think, why would you do it, right? For the kind of the wrong kinds of scrutiny, and for the terrible pay, and for the lack of power because the civil service is too strong, and so on. And this vicious cycle, I think, is something that we need to address. And I haven't got all the answers for it, I'm afraid.
And just one more thought from me. I listened to a very interesting webinar the other day about what we may expect should there be a Labour government at some point this year, in the unlikely event of... and one of
heaven
the things...
That,
I know, imagine such a thing. And one of the things that was pressed very, very hard was just how much Starmer is going to press on this issue about standards in public life. Now, an interesting one when we think about Rayner, and one of, you know, cynics might suggest one of the reasons he hasn't looked at the advice on that is because he doesn't want his own hands dipped in potential problematic blood. Fine. But, you know, he is a former director of public prosecutions. This is kind of his strong suit. It is something that I think he genuinely believes in. But much as we had Rishi Sunak quite rightly standing there on the steps of Downing Street and saying integrity, accountability, transparency, only for that to blow up in his face about a week into his premiership, you know, Starmer is also going to be on a expend an awful lot of political capital on creating a very, very high bar. They're going to review the ministerial code, which is already very high, and making this one of the central tenets of his first term is to improve standards in public life. Are they needed? Absolutely, 100%. Will the hope and the ambition fall, you know, come quite high above the reality of it? Yes, I suspect it will. And I don't think that makes me some sort of terrible cynic to suggest such a thing.
That is, it's interesting you say that, Kirsty. I mentioned this before, but I was at an event a few weeks ago with Alistair Campbell, and he was saying basically if Starmer was to absolutely go for the standards and public life message, you know, we will restore standards, et cetera, then that would tip them over the finish line basically at this point. And I was sitting there going, I wonder if the reason he's not doing that is because he feels he can't do that. And then sort of shortly thereafter, questions around Angela Rayner really intensified. And I thought, you've got to be careful, because if you play the card on, we will uphold, we will improve standards in public life, and the perception is, oh, hang on a second, you can't, you're not doing that, then you kind of shot yourself in the foot.
Yeah, but I mean, I think he genuinely believes it's important and he values it and it's important to him. I think it's part of his kind of DNA and his code. And B, after this whole holy nonsense, what choice has he got but to say, I will restore public trust in politics. I will restore trust in standards in public life.
No one can disagree with that stuff. I think the flip side, the one concern is that if you hold everybody to that kind of the wife of Caesar must be seen to be beyond reproach standard, pretty quickly, even with the big majority that Labour may unfortunately find themselves with, you start running out of decent quality people, and we don't have the concomitant mechanism for forgiveness, for rehabilitation, for, you know, old school Christian ideas of grace, of forgiving those who don't deserve to be forgiven, all these sorts of things that have held civilization, not to put too grandiose a point on it, together for so long. Now, there are some things, obviously, we think there's a society that you don't deserve rehabilitation from, exactly, right? People, murder and whole life orders and all that kind of stuff. But we don't have a grown-up conversation after the media have gone and got the scalp, however justified it was, for how that person gets to come back again. You know, so you look at someone again, like my boss, who got what I think unfairly done, and it's all very boring and complicated tax stuff that we could go into if we had more hours. But a guy has got so much to give in public life. And if he goes, do you know what? Fine, you don't want my help, even though I did the vaccines and blah, 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 and takes his toys off and goes and does something else, then society is the poorer for it. And do we have that kind of mechanism? Are we grown up enough to have that kind of nuanced conversation about how we rehabilitate people? Or is it actually, if you're an MP, tough, you should have known better, that's it, done, you're out, and we turf them out and have them have a by-election every time? I don't know the answer to that, but I think we need to think about this.
I think you're right. I think we've gone way past the point where we as a society can approach this in any kind of mature and proportionate way. But that is not the same thing as saying that the politicians don't get second acts. A lot of them do. They are usually of their own making, has to be said, rather than, you know, society at large coming along and forgiving you. And we'll probably talk about second acts a lot more when we talk about Liz Truss and her wonderful book. But, you know, but we see time and time again careers that you would have thought would, you know, had ended in such a spectacularly appalling way that there is no way back. And yet, you know, up they resurrect again, either like Lazarus or like Nosferatu, depending on on your individual views of someone, I suppose. But
this is becoming a very cultured episode of this podcast today, isn't it? I like that. It's great. Good. Really fascinating conversation, actually, both. Thank you for that. I think the standards in public life question that flows from this is definitely one of them. I actually was struck by this tweet from Kate McCann as well, who's Times Radio's political editor, because it gives you a sense of when a story like this breaks, where the journalists go next. So she's got a list of questions here. How long have the Tories been aware and why no action? Why was Menzies allowed to voluntarily relinquish the whip instead of having it removed? Thousands of pounds has allegedly been taken from campaign funds for medical expenses. Has it been spent on medical expenses? How were party funds allegedly signed over to an MP's bank account without prompting concern? As reportedly raised by his aide, is there any potential for blackmail here? And are there safeguarding questions if, as Grant Shapps has said on the round this morning, there's potentially a very troubled individual involved? I just thought I'd read that out because I think it does give you a sense of how the journalists move now.
Yeah, all very excellent, perfectly valid questions. And we certainly haven't heard the last of this story, that's for sure.
Right, thank you for that, both. Let me tell you about the Resident Hotel, where I just stayed. That's right, I have been to the Resident in Liverpool for a lovely, lovely stay. I have to be honest, it was wonderful, and I'm not just saying that. I promise you it was great. The warmest of welcome from the lovely reception team, including a lovely welcome card signed by Megan and the Resident team. We were offered a map, we were offered guidance on where to go for food and for drinks. The location was great. We had several activities in Liverpool. We had a friend's birthday dinner. Then we were bowling, we were doing all of that stuff, and all of it was within a 10-minute walk of where the hotel was, which was perfect. Not only that, we had guidance on the best local restaurants and bars where we could also get discounts as a result of staying at the Resident. The little kitchen in the hotel room was very, very helpful for coffee drinkers. Unbelievably, I'm not one. There's a little coffee machine right there as well. Do you know what was lovely as well? City centre location. Double glazing. There was the outdoor window, then an indoor window. No noise. I slept like an actual log. Beautiful room, very spacious, well equipped, lovely hotel, lovely staff, lovely location. Take this as a personal endorsement. I've been there, done that, and you should do the same. Stay at the Resident. Shall we go on to discuss Rwanda very briefly, I think, at this point? Because the ping pong continues is the top line. The BBC writes it like this. The government's showdown with the House of Lords over its Rwanda deportation bill continues. Peers have voted to demand changes to the bill, including an amendment which would ban sending people who have assisted the UK military to Rwanda. MPs had previously or earlier overturned a series of changes to the legislation, which were made by the Lords on Monday. This is, of course, to... The plan is to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, but it has been going back and forth in something of a protracted standoff over the final wording. Another vote now expected on Monday, James. Will there be a flight to Rwanda with asylum seekers on it before the election?
You put me on the spot here. It's how much money are we sending to Rwanda? $50 million question. I think the reason this gets so much attention is just that it shows my particular bugbear, and so I guess I would try and make it all about this, of the toothlessness now of the modern state, right? It is very obvious that people want illegal immigration to be cut basically to zero. It's a very popular thing. It's why the Conservatives made stopping the boats one of their five priorities, because, of course, that list of five priorities is focus grouped and polled to absolute death. So we know that it's a big issue. It's been put front and center. The Prime Minister says it's a big priority. Everyone's very angry about it. And yet still, the fifth biggest economy in the world, one of the strongest military powers in the world, is unable to get over this hurdle because a foreign court is saying so, because some of the Lords are saying so, because. And people are so fed up of excuses when, you know, we started this parliament by saying, just get Brexit done. And suddenly, boom, everything seemed to be done and people weren't worried anymore. And now we can't get one plane away to a country that gets to advertise its tourism on every Arsenal shirt. And I wonder whether Keir Starmer, who I think is a big Arsenal fan, must watch his team every week, seeing Visit Rwanda across the strip and have a wry smile to himself. And people will be rightly frustrated with why can't the state even manage to do what should be a fairly simple thing? The French, who are inside the EU and inside the ECHR, managed to deport a guy to Tunisia 8 hours after he said death to France. Why can't we do this? It's a great question.
Well, one of the main reasons, I humbly suggest, is because of Boris Johnson and his Brexit deal that tore up the Dublin Accord, which would have allowed us to have a returns agreement with the European Union, or, which is what we had before Brexit. However, the only things I will say about this, interesting to note that I think Downing Street were pretty convinced that had the last ping. The Lords clearly think there's one more pong to be had in it. We are down from eight, like battling over eight amendments down to the final two, one of which is about they want some independent view on whether Rwanda is safe or not, as opposed to just the government going, yep, totally safe. We said so, so it's fine. And also this ongoing battle about whether there should be an exemption for Afghan interpreters, ostensibly. And so I think that Number 10 were a little bit caught on the hot on this. It will go back. It'll be interesting to see whether how much Liberal Democrat, Labour and crossbench peers wants to push this again next week. My guess is it'll probably fold next week. There's usually only two pings and pongs to take it to a third ping and pong. They've made their point, as it were, but never has so much time, money and effort been expended on such a poor piece of policy. On the same webinar that I was listening to the other day, though, they were talking about how Labour would tackle this, and they casually sort of said, oh, well, you know, and they'll have a returns agreement with Europe. Will they? I mean, if you can get a returns agreement with Europe without going into a single market or, you know, the customs union or a customs union, I would be astonished. I mean, look, I'm not saying it's not worth pursuing in terms of kicking a can down a road, but I would be absolutely astonished, because if it was that simple, frankly, even Rishi Sunak's government would have been able to nail it by now. The only other point I will make about this is a story floating around in the papers the other day about other potential third countries that we might use in the same vein as we're looking to do Rwanda, one of which was Costa Rica. And I just wonder if you're one of these people that's come over on a boat and you're in this sort of lottery of, what did you get? Oh, I got Rwanda. Never mind. I got Costa Rica. Whoop, whoop. I mean, you know, it's not exactly on a kind of par, is it? So,
given the kind of housing crisis that we've got in the UK, I mean, I'm tempted to be sent off to Costa Rica to start a new life. That doesn't sound so bad.
Yeah. I'll come into the office once or twice a month. Thank you very much. Fine. Oh, live on a beach. Man. Right, works well, for me.
The ping pong may be nearing an end. We'll touch on that, I'm sure, next week if there is a conclusion. Right. Shall we go on to everyone's favourite new author? This is, of course, Liz Truss, the former Prime Minister, whose book is out. First of all, full disclosure, I haven't read it. Have either of you read it? I've read lots of the extracts, lots of the excerpts. James, have you read it?
I've got a copy here in the Adam Smith Institute downstairs, and I've got a team of researchers pouring over it as we speak.
Okay, good. Kirsty, have you dived into Liz Truss's reflections?
I have read extensive excerpts and serializations and enjoyed every word.
There is an overarching thought here on, is Liz Truss being unfairly mocked for her reflections and considerations on her time, her just shy of 50 days as Prime Minister. James, is she getting a fair run?
Not in terms of the policies and the ideas and all the rest of it. I think the problem is, of course, the execution. And I think this is the really long-term chronic problem, that all of the things that she says perfectly legitimate, I think. I'm, you know, speaking to you from the Adam Smith Institute. I'm a big free marketeer, sort of small state classical liberal, and I've got as much of a problem with the blob as Liz does. But the fact that she is the person still saying it and hasn't really gone quietly into that good night for a long time now. She waited about, 10 minutes before that big long telegraph piece saying that she was right all along, and hasn't really been quiet since. Now, if she'd have had a long period of quiet, and things have been as tough and gone as badly as they have for Rishi since, and then she'd have popped up about now for the first time and said, hey, I told you so, right? You're more unpopular now than we were when I, you know, had my mini budget and everything went awry for a little while. But at least we'd have had a load of big fundamental reforms to the state and to the economy that we could look forward to reaping the benefits of. People might have gone, yeah, okay, maybe. But I think it's that sort of lack of humility that's been a problem, because I agree with a lot of her diagnosis. And of course, her execution was so poor. And frankly, a little bit of it was all quite arrogant in terms of not telling people what was going to be in that mini budget beforehand and stress testing it and all the rest. That set the cause of shrinking the state and growing the economy back quite a long way.
Fair. Okay, so there's the policy consideration in all of this, Kirsty, isn't there? And we take James's point on that potentially. What are your thoughts on that, first of all?
My thoughts, I'm in complete agreement with James on this one. There are plenty of sensible points being made in the book about the scale of the quangocracy, is that right, that now exists in Britain, the extraordinary amount of powers that we've handed over to unelected people, although this book should come with a irony klaxon because being lectured about unelected people by a woman that was put in power by 81,000 conservative members, you know, you can see the problem with that from a sort of from a start point. But she's right about, you know, she's right about how many powers we've handed out to people that we have no control and oversight over. She's right about the OBR. The OBR is as wrong as it's right. In fact, it's probably more wrong than it's right. And it is entirely baffling to me why this government and even the incoming Labour government want themselves to be, you know, hamstrung by an organisation that, you know, is about as reliable as a weather vane, as far as I can work out. Utterly baffling. Do I think the OBR plotted to bring Liz Truss down? No, I don't. But I do think that that we should increasingly question its role in our society. So I think there's plenty of sensible stuff in the book about some of the concerns, and there is obviously sensible stuff to be had about, you know, and particularly when we see what's happening in Israel with Iran this week, the need for liberal democracies to basically pick a side and stick with it in the face of this ever-growing threat of authoritarian power. So all the kind of issues that she lays out, there's nothing wrong with them. The issue is the messenger, and no one is going to heed this from Liz because of the time that she spent in office and the legacy that she left. You know, so I think some of that gets overshadowed by some of the rest of it, and we can talk about some of the rest of it. But a lot of what she says about what is wrong with our society, and we've said this before, one of the biggest things that should be on Keir Starmer's unsexy to-do list will be complete regulatory reform. It is long overdue in this country, and it is completely hampering our ability to do anything for the benefit of this country, to build infrastructure, to have a green transition, to build the homes that we need. We've outsourced all these kind of decision-making bodies to different bodies, by the way, all who have different concerns in life. So, you know, you might have an organization determined to have growth up against the Environment Agency, whose sole purpose is to say, no, you can't build a factory here or 10,000 homes here because of the lesser-spotted newt in the middle of a field. I mean, it's barking, absolutely barking.
Sure.
This move from elected leaders here into these regulatory bodies, normally regulators like to accrue more powers, right? It's sort of in their interest. The bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy, all that kind of stuff. But the scale that we've been pushing stuff onto them is so rapid and so vast and so untested that you're even finding regulators saying, I'm not sure I want all of this. Something like the Online Safety Bill, Online Safety Act as it now is, that gave all these sweeping extra powers to Ofcom. Talk to Ofcom, they didn't want this stuff. They've not got a plan for it. And the politicians are trying to abnegate this responsibility, which is bad enough. But then you find, you know, that you can see behind me, the Department for Education, when we were in there and the various other bits have been sent to Ofsted and all the rest of it, still the education secretary who gets it in the neck for this kind of stuff. And when we go and we try and pull a big lever that says fix, and nothing happens, and you go into the bowels of this metaphor and you find that lever isn't connected to anything because it's gone with somewhere else or it's been put somewhere else, that doesn't cut it with people. They go, oh, well, okay, you voted to get rid of the power for yourself. It's for the regulator now. I guess we're not going to hold the politician on the hook. Doesn't happen. You might as well have the power and the responsibility to go with it together to try and get some of these things fixed.
Exactly. And so then, on Liz Truss, is she overshadowed by what has become the kind of conversation around this? A complete lack of self-reflection, a complete lack of awareness of what happened during those kind of 49 days.
Oh my gosh. The first thing I thought about this book, right, is didn't she get a friend to read it? I mean, never mind the editor or the publisher or something. Didn't she get anyone that likes Liz to read this book and say, do you know what, Liz, this bit where the queen dies and you reflect on the queen dying and say, why me? Why did this happen to me? Why now? And make the queen's death about you? This makes you look a little self-absorbed and lacking in self-awareness. Just a tad. Didn't she get anyone to de-Liz the book? I mean, it's like 100% Liz. I mean, you know, I mean, by her own admission, she's an odd duck and all her odd duckery is out there in kind of glorious Technicolor for everyone who's been touring the studios all week. But just get a friend to read it and go, you might want to just hoik this bit out here or hoik out the bit where you're going, boo-hoo, I'm the prime minister and I have to do my own hair. You might want to hoik that bit out too. Very bizarre that, you know, so on the one hand, you've got this, it's an absolutely potty book. You know, on the one hand, you've got these, you know, challenges about, you know, the rise of authoritarian states across the globe and, you know, the evil axis of China and Russia and, and Iran. And on the other hand, she's moaning about getting her barnet done and getting a Ocado delivery through number two. It's bonkers. I mean, it's wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. Go and buy it.
I'm going to defend it in a few ways. So one, I think, because I like a challenge. One, I think that having it be that kind of authentic is going to be an amazing boon for future historians because it will help work out what went wrong. As you say, for it being 100% unfiltered like that. But I think, again, I happen to agree that, you know, A, from a human perspective, you think, God, why me on day two of the job? But I can see that being a fairly human response.
Oh, you can think it, James. You can think it, but do not put it in a book to expose your self-absorption for the world to see. That's what you should do.
But I'm even going to defend her on this hair point, right? So the United States of America president has a massive team of butlers, of body men, yeah, who get his suit ready every day and press and all this kind of stuff. And that you have, you know, that is something that I don't want the prime minister, the leader of a nuclear power, to be worrying about. I don't want him or her to be worrying about this kind of stuff. They need to look presentable. The flats inside number 10, all the facilities are really terrible. And I think I'm someone partly to blame. When I worked somewhere like the Taxpayers Alliance, we'd have a go if someone was getting any of this kind of state funding. But the French president and the French president's wife, they get full-time hairdressers, they get full-time makeup artists, all this kind of stuff. And if you're looking good, you're not having to worry about those sorts of things or where the Ocado delivery is coming from. And let's take it one step more seriously. Boris had, I think, famously some money concerns, and that there was some concerns that would turn into things with donors and all the rest of it. Just give the guy a bigger salary, give him a trust, have all this stuff be put into a blind trust so you can focus on the act of governing. I think that's something we're massively lacking. You know, and again, in America, everybody has full-time drivers and security and all the rest of it. And for most members of the cabinet, they only get a car a couple of times a week and don't get the rest of the time. And we're already seeing the threats against MPs and things like that. So again, on these things, I agree with her, but you're right. It's such an unsympathetic messenger. Will make it, it's a lot longer before I get my own prime ministerial makeup artist in 25 years.
And yes, to some certain extent, I do agree that it is a bit, the infrastructure around our prime minister and the salary of our prime minister are both a bit barking to me. But having said that, you know, some of this is about the media's response to stuff, you know. Rishi gets a helicopter. Ooh, Rishi's millionaire gets helicopter when he should have got on Southern Rail. Exactly. You know, have you been on Southern Rail recently? Do you want your prime minister to turn up for things or do you not? You know, so I get a lot of that. And I've been on a couple of the really old planes that we fly our prime minister around on, and they're scary. I mean, they're really scary. So at some point, we're going to have to upgrade those to a plane that I have more faith won't just plummet out of the sky. I mean, seriously, we used to land and bits used to fall off this thing, you know.
It's a good metaphor for the state of the government, right?
Oh, well, state of the country right now. I mean, on a couple of occasions when we flew in and out of in Northern Ireland on a particularly dark and stormy night, me and a couple of people that weren't the greatest flyers, including the Prime Minister, practically holding the walls of this plane, it was terrifying. So yes, I agree with all of that, but again, don't put it in a book. You wanted to be the Prime Minister, regardless of what you say in your book, you worked very hard to become the Prime Minister. Don't then moan about the fact that you've got to do your own makeup and your own hair. It looks a little churlish, to put it mildly, when all you will be remembered for as the Prime Minister is being in such a rush to inflict your political ideology on a country that didn't elect you, that you've added thousands and thousands of pounds to millions of people's mortgages. That's all you'll be remembered for. So don't bitch and whine in a book about having to do your own hair.
And that's fair. Well, if we're going really inside baseball, do you want one more flying anecdote? So again, this will be defending Rishi from all these helicopters. The RAF have these helicopters around, right, for when they're needed for emergencies, and they need to fly them anyway, right? So if they're not being used to ferry Rishi around, they're being used just empty to keep them in good working order and the training for the pilots and all the rest of it. So frankly, I think it's fine for more ministers to be using them. But we had one once to get from Glasgow to the Orkney Islands. There's no other way to get there for some meeting we had. And when you go over the Highlands, the air pressure changes quite a lot because you can't go too high and too low. And so it's pretty bumpy all the way through. And the pilot's going, look, I'm the best of the best. Don't worry, RAF trained, all the rest of it. And that was all fine. The problem was that the armed post protection officer sat next to me, grabbing my knee on a particularly bumpy bit, thinking, well, if you're worried, I've got no hope.
No.
I've got a couple of pictures of some very frightened aides in a helicopter grabbing Theresa May's knee when we'd hit some sort of pocket and dropped about what felt like 100 foot, I'm sure it was. And if you want to get even more inside baseball with it, and I'm not putting any kind of security issues here, but I suspect one of the reasons we've got greater use of helicopters at this particular moment too is the airport that the Prime Minister usually flies out of is being refurbished, and so they've had to go to another airport, which is even further out from London than the one that was. So it takes a ridiculous amount of time to get out to the airport to fly off somewhere. So in terms of, you know, a Prime Minister who's usually quite time poor, being able to get someone in a helicopter rather than spending whatever it is, an hour and a half trying to get to the airfield before you've even flown anywhere.
Inside politics is what we do. These are the stories we want. I love it. Right, we've got a few minutes left before we've got to let James go and live his life. Let's talk, James, about your thread on Kemi Badenoch from this week, which I thought was particularly eye-catching. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. You started, over 48 hours, the business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, has made not one, but four really impressive and brave interventions across education, health, business, and liberties. They show the best combination of conservative and classical liberal thinking and are deeply encouraging. So I suppose, first of all, what are the issues about to which you refer and Kemi Badenoch's interventions on them?
Sure. So I think the first one here, I've got to make sure I remember all of them now. The first one is the fact that she was the only member of the cabinet and the highest profile serving minister to vote in this free vote on smoking against this smoking ban. And that shows courage for her to break ranks with the rest of her cabinet colleagues. And she did a little bit of a thread herself as to the reasons about it. You know, yes, smoking bad for you, but people should have civil liberties about these things. Education more important than other things. The sort of illogic of living a kind of two-tier legal system where into the future someone who's 41 is going to be able to buy cigarettes but someone who's 40 isn't, you know, all these sorts of ludicrous things that classical liberal think tanks like the Adam Smith Institute have been saying for a long time. That was great. She then weighed in, because she's got the equalities brief as well, about the victory for the Michaela Community School run by the self-appointed strictest headmistress in Britain. The school won a high court battle to be able to conduct its own legal timetable, and this was about preventing a student from stopping and praying whenever she wanted. And that sort of showed that the respect that we've got for teachers and for having this kind of discipline in schools. Thought that was great. She also weighed in on the CAS review that came out and that talked about the dangers of social transitioning and other kinds of transitioning between sexes of children. That's a very, very dangerous minefield for anybody to weigh into. I'd be dangerous to me even talk about it myself. And then I think the other element of it was that the Labour Party chair had said, well, Labour's going to help black and brown businesses to thrive. And this kind of nasty, I think quite horrible racial divisiveness that Labour are trying to push. And she said, look, she grew up a part of her life in Nigeria. I grew up where this kind of tribal politics is common and it's horrible and it doesn't work and it's very unpleasant and we shouldn't be doing it. So four big different areas that sort of just about cover her brief in this free vote. It shows, I think, an ideological consistency that's really encouraging. And that, you know, so many politicians have either cast away their ideology or have never had one in the first place. And people like to say, well, ideology is bad, I just do what works. And I think that's to be unmoored from having a kind of set of clear first principles as to how you would react and how to try and be consistent in governing. And the fact that she's thinking like this, and hopefully it means that other leadership contenders, because let's not fool ourselves, we have to look at it through this sort of dynamic, this lens, will be thinking about where they stand ideologically as well. So that's one of the big battles that's going to happen. Should the outside chance of the Conservatives losing the general election, there will be an almighty battle for the sort of soul of the party. What does conservatism look like in the 21st century? How do we lick our wounds and come back after what's been a pretty difficult time in government and all these big
Kirsty, a thought on Kemi Badenoch and her leadership credentials?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into a debate about pragmatic politics versus ideology in politics.
We'll do that next time.
That is for another day. I will notice two things, though. So a party that gave you Liz Truss is also the party that gives you Kemi Badenoch at the moment. And for all the criticisms and the, you know, the hand wringing about, you know, the Tory party is completely bereft of ideas and rudderless and has no sense of direction, and it will completely implode after the election, etc. And woe is the centre right. You know, look at a woman like this. She is bright, she is sharp, she is articulate, she knows what she wants in life. I will, and she's had a very good week as well, because obviously the attack on Stoughton as post office former chairman who accused her of smearing him, that's obviously gone in her favour too, because a review has found him kind of guilty as charged, as it were, of, shall we say, poor behaviours in the workplace. So she's had a very, very good week. Fine. The one thing I would say when we're talking about personalities of people and their propensity to lead, you know, and I've noticed this, you know, if you'd asked me before I worked at Number 10, yes, we worked in a particularly tricky time when we had to be super, super nice to everyone because we had no majority. Fine, I get that. But it was also in the nature of Theresa May to work to build consensus, to surround yourself with people that aren't groupthink people, that don't think just like you, and to try and move forward in, you know, with compromise, the necessary compromises and trade-offs that we all need to make in life, right? If you'd asked me before I'd worked at Number 10, I'd have said the most important thing you need as a leader is the ability to take a decision. For good or for ill, preferably for good, take a decision, right? It is very important, but I think one of the other things is to be able to take, and you'll never take everybody with you, but take as many people with you as you can when you take a decision. And my big concern about Kemi, and this is not, you know, we've talked before about having complementary people in a team. So you can have a personality, a dominant personality, but it needs to be ameliorated by some of the trusted people around you. She has a tendency to go studs up. And going studs up, you know, in opposition is great. You know, going studs up when you need to build alliances, build up relationships, politics. Ultimately, even at the top, even on a global stage, is about people. And people will go further for you. You know, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar, right? And so her natural gut instinct on everything is to go studs up. And so my one completely unasked for piece of advice for her would be just mind how you go with your natural instincts. She's got good gut instincts. She's as sharp as she likes. She's incredibly intelligent. She's got, you know, all the right kind of makings, but she needs to be careful of this, because if one thing's going to trip her up personally, it will be her ability to, think for, you know, talk first and, and think later. Going studs up is almost never the right way to go in politics, particularly in public. So that's my only kind of concern about her. But, you know, look at the other contenders that she's got. I mean, for me, it's a bit of a no contest. Grant Shapps, who almost certainly won't be an MP, seems to think that he's leadership material. Well, if he keeps his seat, I would be very, very surprised. So for me, look, she's head and shoulders, but she needs to be careful of her own instincts, if you like, to go for the jugular.
I think that's a great great piece of advice. Do you talk about consensus and bringing people along with you? I'm reminded of when Margaret Thatcher was asked, yeah, you're a consensus politician. Obviously, everybody thought she was. And she said, of course I'm a consensus politician. I believe there should be a consensus around what I say and do. And her big criticism, again, was that she was exactly as you're fearing that Kemi may be. That Mrs. Thatcher, especially in the early days when she was nervous and was unpopular in the polls and all these sorts of things, that she would... instead of chairing and leading meetings, she'd be a kind of leading discursant in them. She would hector her team around her in front of other people and belittle them. And she had all these terrible man management problems from I think, again, a lack of perhaps time in business. And my big hero is a chap called John Hoskins, who was her first policy unit chair. He wrote a book called Just in Time, that's I think the best book so far until Kirsten wrote one of hers about time inside Number 10. And it was all about, again, the civil service being terrible and how you unpick all these big issues strategically. But the other thing he said was about Mrs. Thatcher's poor man management ability. And he wrote a note that was going to try and be helpful for her. And she took it completely the wrong way and said, how dare you betray me and talk to me like this and all these sorts of things. And then, you know, the Falklands happened and the economy turned around and she got and won all these great victories and so never bothered to fix this big fatal flaw that she had until it was too late and it was eventually her downfall. So hopefully, Kemi will learn this lesson of history.
Very interesting, and avoid that trap. Well, yeah, indeed. There's lots of ifs and buts.
James, thank you very much.
It's been great to have you on. Thanks for joining us. And thank you, Kirsty. Great to have you as well. Always,
thank you so
always,
much having
always.
Me, guys.
Thanks for your time. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being with us. We take you inside politics on Whitehall Sources. We'll do it all again next week.